Welcome to the Space Show, Sean.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
I've got a very interesting looking book in front of me here. It's called The International Mars Research Station. What's it all about?
Well, it's a project I've been working on for 2 years. It includes a bunch of ideas that I've developed during my 16 years of involvement with the Mars exploration community and the Mars Society. Fundamentally, it contains a new Mars mission architecture for sending humans to Mars. It's based on the NASA plan, but with a few variations, mainly incorporating a new space hardware such as SpaceX Dragon capsules, SpaceX Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy rockets, Bigelow inflatable space habitats, and emphasis on in-situ resource utilization. So, for example, making all of your water on Mars, air, propellant, energy, these sorts of things.
What's the Bigelow inflatable?
It's developed a number of ideas around inflatable space habitats. The most important one for the near term is the B330, which is inflatable space habitat. Has 24 to 36 layers of protective material which make up the external skin of the habitat, and it includes life support for up to 6 inhabitants long term. So it can support people on the moon, on Mars, in interplanetary space. They're looking to make a space station. They can be multiple of these can be connected together. Each one has 330 square meters of internal volume, which is quite large for a space habitat.
You mean cubic meters?
Cubic meters, sorry, you're right. This makes it much larger, for example, than the ISS, sort of per person, and much lower density. So they're quite light. They're about 20 to 22 tons of mass, which is a lot lighter than an ISS module, but yet provides life support for 6 people. So this is really the next generation of space habitat.
So I suppose it's sort of compacted down like a folded up tent.
Yes.
And then unfolded in space, which would make launch quite a bit easier than launching a full volume habitat.
That's right. So they can be launched with a diameter about half of what the final diameter will be once it's inflated. So the fact that it can be launched much smaller means a much smaller launch vehicle, and it's also lighter. So the small launch vehicle makes it much, much cheaper to get into space, and you can inflate it and fit it out on orbit. So this is obviously a big advantage.
And they're going to test this on the space station very soon, aren't they?
Yes, they're not testing the B330, but they've developed another one. It's called the BEAM, the Bigelow excursion something module, I can't remember, but this is going to be attached to the ISS as a sort of a proof of concept of these inflatable type space habitats.
So that means that we're on a trip to Mars, we don't have to launch the full volume straight away. We can inflate it either on the way or when we get there.
To be honest, for this architecture, my intention is that it would be inflated and fitted out on Earth. So while this is an advantage of these habitats, is that you can launch them deflated, for a Mars mission, you would assume the budget would be there to launch it in a larger vehicle. You don't need many of these. You only need 2 habitats for this architecture. You need 1 transit habitat and 1 surface habitat. So, you know, it doesn't require a lot. The main point of difference for this architecture over for something like the NASA Design Reference Architecture is that you're focusing on a single location. That's why it's called the International Mars Research Station. So the intention is to run multiple missions to 1 location on Mars, simply because it's cheaper. You can build up infrastructure on the surface, you can provide habitat, a camper, being a pressurized rover for surface exploration, and you can reuse that hardware over multiple missions. And this makes it a lot more cost effective, because of course the main barrier at the moment to sending humans to Mars is the price, right? So the concept behind this plan is to spread the cost across 10 different countries, makes it cheaper for everyone, focus on 1 location, and therefore save money, reuse the hardware and save money. So I think with all those measures in place to make the whole mission a lot cheaper, you can fit out the thing on the ground, like inflate it and fully fit it out with all the equipment, computers, furniture, everything you need on Earth, launch it in that inflated state, send it to Mars that way. Because if you don't, it means that when the astronauts actually arrive at Mars, they then have to fit out this empty habitat on the surface of Mars, which would be quite difficult. and time-consuming, and you know, it's far more effective to have a fully set up habitat ready on Mars for when the astronauts arrive.
Now, there's an American called Robert Zubrin who has an idea of landing a series of habitats or hab modules, but at different locations, but within reach of each other.
Yes.
You're advocating them in the same place. Now, what's the pros and cons of each approach?
In Dr. Zubrin's plan, which I am a big fan of, his plan has some very salient virtues, but in his plan, each landing requires a separate habitat because the astronauts actually land in the habitat. And the habitat is a large piece of hardware, very difficult, expensive to land on Mars. In my plan, you're landing the crews on Mars in Dragon capsules. So you may have seen the Dragon version 2 is designed to land on solid ground, which is quite a breakthrough. It means that these capsules can land on Mars, which is what they're designed for. That's the inspiration.
That's the capsule designed by SpaceX.
That's right, yep. So these are a lot cheaper compared to landing a habitat on Mars. So instead of having to land a habitat with every single mission, which is what you need to do if you're going to go to lots of different places, you can just land one or two habitats at one location and then run however many missions you like by landing crews in Dragon capsules. Now, the way you can achieve a similar objective to exploring large areas of Mars is providing good surface exploration, and Dr. Zubrin's plan advocates that as well. If you can provide methane oxygen-fueled pressurized rover on the surface, you can explore maybe up to 1,000 kilometres around your base, which is a fairly large area of Mars. So you can still do a lot of exploration from a single point. And of course, it's just a starting point. Once you've established that foothold on Mars, you've basically set up some infrastructure, and then you can go to the next location. But you need to establish that foothold, you need to make it as cheap as possible, and to really get the ball rolling with colonisation and settlement.
Which brings us to the question, why should we go to Mars? Why should we colonise it?
Well, I think Baz Lansdorp puts this really well. You know, there's a lot of bad news around when we talk about the future. Humanity needs something positive to look forward to. You know, colonising other planets is in our future. It's inevitable. We have that frontier mentality to want to expand our horizons and go to new places and have the freedom to have dangerous adventure, as some people have put it. Going to Mars is something that enough people want to do that it will certainly happen inevitably. And not just Mars, but the Moon and other planets in other solar systems. So it will happen. And the benefit of the frontier is that it's a zone of creativity. We have a lot of global systems in place now on Earth, but by going to a new planet, we can create new systems for government, for economies, new ways of education. You know, it's a place where we can say, okay, here's an opportunity to do things differently. And that's why I think Mars is important.
Now, what are some of the other aspects that you discuss in the book?
I talk a lot about in situ resource utilisation. So in Dr. Zubrin's plan, he talks, one of the main innovations is in situ propellant production. So landing a lander on Mars for the return vehicle and making most of the propellant from Martian resources. I'm saying make all the propellant from Martian resources. Take equipment with you that enables you to extract water from the air as well as from the ground. Also make your air from Martian resources. Martian atmosphere has carbon dioxide, nitrogen, argon. You can certainly make breathable air from that with fairly simple chemical engineering. You can make get all of your drinking water from Mars. This isn't very difficult engineering, but what it does is greatly reduces the amount of mass that you need to take with you to Mars. And the thing is that, for example, the design reference architecture, as well as Dr. Zubrin's architecture, Mars Direct, talks about taking hydrogen from Earth, mixing it with oxygen that you obtain from Mars, from the Martian atmosphere, to make water or to make propellant. Mars has lots of water. There's 5 million cubic kilometres of water been identified at the Martian surface, at least. So isn't it better to develop the technology to get that water from Mars, since we ultimately need it anyway for settlement? We have to learn to use those resources. So yes, it will be. It's not technologically simple to learn how to get water out of the Martian regolith, but it's possible. You know, it's within the capabilities. Probably simpler than something like the Curiosity rover. It's within our capabilities to do that. So we should do that. And by getting our hydrogen from Mars, all our water from Mars, we then reduce our mass that we need to send out there by that much, which is a big advantage. It actually really affects your design of your Mars ascent vehicle, the design, you know, the amount of supplies you need to send with your habitat and things like that.
The chemical reactions that are needed to make that fuel need a lot of energy input. Where are you going to get that energy from?
In my architecture, I'm using solar energy. Now, this is a little bit of a divergence. Most Mars mission architectures have historically looked to nuclear power, but there's a few things you can do to make solar energy viable for that. By landing at optimal latitudes in terms of solar power, for example, in the mid-northern latitudes, you can you increase the amount of solar energy that you have access to, and also by using the latest solar energy technology. So we have CIGS solar technology now, which is much more efficient, enables you to get greater utility from solar energy, but means that you don't need as much area of solar cells. It means that you can deliver solar thin film solar cells in a fabric sort of form, printed sort of fabric form, so you can send up huge blankets of it and unroll it on the surface. And this is one of the things Mars One is doing as well. So this means that you can deploy much larger areas of solar material on the surface of Mars with less mass, and capable of providing enough power. Like in Mars Direct, they're talking about using 100 kilowatts of power to produce enough propellant to take you all the way back to Earth. I only need enough propellant to get to Mars orbit, and that can be done using photovoltaic cells, solar energy. I thought it would be interesting to go through the architecture, how we actually get the humans to Mars and back. So this is a little bit of a variation from the NASA design reference architecture, and the main difference being that we land the crew in capsules rather than in habitats, which is simply cheaper and safer. The thing is that landing stuff on Mars is difficult. As we saw with the Curiosity rover, which is a 900 kilo payload, that was the largest thing we've ever landed on Mars, and we needed a sky crane, which was considered the least crazy of all of the ideas that were proposed. Very technically complex. And this is under 1 ton payload. When you're talking about landing a Mars habitat, you're talking about landing a payload between 20 and 40 tons. And this is really the main blocker with humans to Mars mission architectures. So what SpaceX have done with developing the Dragon V2 is they've built a capsule which can carry 7 astronauts that can land on solid ground. So far, historically, we've always landed capsules in the ocean. But by being able to land on solid ground, apart from the fact that it saves the cost and time of a water recovery, means that these things can be landed on the Moon, on Mars, any planet with a solid surface, which suddenly opens up all kinds of possibilities for interplanetary exploration. So in this particular architecture, because we aren't landing the crew in a habitat, this gives you another opportunity, which is pre-deployment of the habitat. What you can do if you pre-deploy the habitat is set up your in-situ resource utilization processes 26 months early, before the crew, even longer, because the crew has still got to get there. But it means you've got this nice window of time when you can send robots to cruise around and collect water from the surface, you can pull water out of the atmosphere, you can make your air, you can make propellant. But this is a big advantage. It means that if you can extract all those resources and have them ready to go before the crew even leave Earth, you've suddenly got all of this security. You know that you've got a Mars ascent vehicle already on the surface, fueled and ready to go. You also know that you've got a habitat that's fully functional, has communications, it has air, it has water, and it's already landed and safely there. And this is before the crew even departs Earth. So you've got suddenly this sense of peace of mind of all you've got to do is successfully land the crew in a capsule on Mars, and they've got everything already there ready to go at the start of the mission. Then all they've got to do is fly for 18 months and come back. So this is the key part of it, is the pre-deployment of the Mars ascent vehicle, the surface habitat, and also the pressurized rover, and you've basically verified that all this stuff works before you even send the crew. And that gives you, obviously, all this peace of mind. Another difference is that the Mars Transfer Vehicle in this architecture is not nuclear powered, which is a technology which is arguably still in its infancy and technologically very difficult to develop and politically difficult to develop, but it's also not hydrogen powered. There's a number of difficulties with hydrogen because it's a very low density propellant, it's very leaky, so you need expensive zero boil off tanks. Technologically it's just more difficult to work with. There's dangers associated with testing with hydrogen and so forth. So what I'm proposing is that we use methane oxygen. So methane oxygen is a popular propellant for certain applications, for example, launching from Mars, because you can make methane oxygen on Mars. You'll find that there's more and more launch vehicles on Earth are starting to look at using methane oxygen. For example, the new SpaceX Raptor engine is a methane oxygen engine, because of all the benefits of methane and oxygen. For one thing, they're both cryogenic, but they have roughly they can be kept at roughly the same temperatures, and that means you can use tanks that are actually combined. So you can use these cryogenic composite combined tanks, where you actually only need to cryogenically cool one of the tanks, and the other one is simply cooled by thermal transfer. It just simplifies the whole design of the engine, and methane is also quite inexpensive. Of course, you can get it from natural gas fairly cheaply. You don't have to do any chemical engineering to make methane, which is another big cost benefit, especially when you need a large amount of propellant. So the Mars Transfer Vehicle is methane and oxygen fueled, and the way that it's fueled is using these expendable propellant pods. So it has a number of bays in it that you launch these expendable propellant pods to. One of the difficulties that we have with cryogenic propellant is on-orbit transfer of the propellant, because it's hard to keep it in a cryogenic state when you're transferring and fueling a vehicle. But if you have these pods which can be launched and the pod itself can be inserted into the vehicle, you haven't got to do a propellant transfer on orbit. You're just transferring a fully fueled propellant pod which can then be used. And then as soon as that pod is empty, you can then discard it, which immediately reduces your vehicle mass by about a ton and a half. And as every time you do that, your vehicle gets lighter. And what it does, because by making the vehicle lighter progressively through the course of the mission, it reduces your overall propellant requirement in the beginning. So this is a big cost saving as well. So it enables you to use this cheaper propellant and do the mass transfer much more easily. And your return mission is simply launching from the Mars Ascent Vehicle, docking with the Mars Transfer Vehicle, which comes back and returns to Earth orbit. So this is another variation from the NASA Design Reference Architecture and other Mars mission architectures, that the Mars Transfer Vehicle is reusable. So there's several advantages to that. One is that you get to reuse the vehicle, right? So you don't have to provide a new Mars Transfer Vehicle every time, which is a large and expensive piece of equipment. So that's a clear advantage. You get to reuse the transfer habitat. The transfer habitat will have been improved. It's been lived in for a year for each mission, because you've got 6 months out and 6 months back. So all of the variations and modifications that the crews will have made to make it a sort of a more habitable space will be preserved. It's also a historical artifact. But also, if you return to low Earth orbit, or anywhere in Earth orbit really, rather than doing a direct entry into the atmosphere, it's a lot better for the crew and safer for the crew to land them that way. Because if they're descending from orbit, they're obviously not subject to such high G-forces. There's not as many issues with having to be sort of 100% accurate as the capsule comes in. Returning from something like an Inspiration Mars trajectory, they're entering the Earth's atmosphere at a very high velocity, too high really to be safe. And the accuracy that's required to get that exactly right is difficult. So if you're descending from orbit, it's much better, safer for the crew, and there's not as much time pressure.
Well, Sean, someone who's interested in this topic, how can they get hold of your book?
It's on all of the Amazon websites. The printed paper version is on the American Amazon website and all the European ones. So if you're in Australia looking for the Kindle version, you can go to amazon.com.au, just search for Sean Moss Mars, and you'll find it, the International Mars Research Station. If you're looking for a paper version, you can get it from Amazon.com, or if you're in Europe, any of the Amazon European websites.
Okay, but not available in the bookshops locally?
Not yet, but we're working on that.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Sean.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm really pleased. Thank you for inviting me.